The Years of Lyndon Johnson. Means of Ascent by Robert A. Caro. Continued. Cassette 14, Side 1. Duggar asked the president for details about the picture, including when it had been taken, but Johnson said not a word and carried the picture back to its place in his wife's room. Some years later, however, Duggar mentioned the photograph to Luis Salas. "Yes, I know the one you mean," Salas said, and found his own copy of it. He showed it to Duggar and said it had been taken on the day of the second primary in 1948, before the polls had closed. For a president to preserve as a personal memento a photograph showing the notorious Box 13 in the possession of his political allies, a photograph which by implication proves that someone was indeed in a position to stuff it, is startling in itself. For him to display the photograph to a hostile journalist is evidence of a psychological need so deep that its demands could not be resisted. It is continuing evidence of the fact that not even his possession of the presidency had eased the insecurities of his youth. Since there had been no box marked Precinct 13 among the 20 brought into the Masters hearing, this was presumably the second box from that precinct, the one to which Salas had referred on the witness stand, and that was not brought to court. Chapter 17. A Love Story. The 1948 Texas senatorial campaign marked the end of the old ways in Texas politics and the beginning of the new. The Johnson campaign taught Texas politicians the power of the media. After that, as Horace Busby puts it, they saw that the way to reach the state was through radio. And, of course, the state was becoming more urban, less rural. The exodus from the small towns had started. So, in subsequent statewide campaigns, candidates no longer campaigned as Coke Stevenson had campaigned in 1948. They no longer drove from one small town to the next. You no longer made the circuit. The campaigning in the courthouse square died out. Coke's campaign was the last campaign of that kind ever waged in Texas. Busby was speaking as he sat in a restaurant in Washington, D.C., looking back on the campaign of almost 40 years before. He had been talking about it for several hours, and now he stopped. Then, after a long pause, he said he had one more point to make. "You should understand," he said. "Coke was good quality. He was a good quality legislator, lieutenant governor, governor." There was another pause. "You should understand," Busby said. "He wasn't as bad as we cut him up to be." But the story of Coke Stevenson was not over when the fight for the Senate seat ended. It was to continue for 27 more years, more than a quarter of a century, for he lived until 1975 when he was 87. That number, therefore, had a double significance in his life. After Justice Black handed down his ruling, Stevenson went back to his ranch and his old life. A longtime friend, hunting companion, and fellow widower, Emil Leffler, a former mayor of Junction, moved in with him. Until she died in 1952, Stevenson's mother, who was in her 80s, would visit him for several weeks at a time. Every morning he would rise at 4 to read, cook the cornbread his mother liked, eat breakfast with her, and then, after washing the dishes, drive her around the ranch. Later, while she napped, he would do his chores, but only those that could be done near the house. During his mother's visits, Coke was never out of earshot of the house. He had lost none of his desire to improve the ranch, which he now expanded to more than 15,000 acres. He sunk the poles for new fences and corrals, sledgehammering 120 posts into the hard Kimball County rock himself because the work was so hard that he could hire nobody to do it. He practiced law from an office in Junction. He still refused to install a telephone on the ranch. Prospective clients who couldn't find him in town had to drive out to the ranch, becoming a familiar figure again in the old Kimball County courthouse. To avoid any hint that he was using his influence with state officials, he took cases mainly for Kimball County families he had known over the years for fees that I could write on a blackboard in my office for all to see and not be ashamed of a single one of them. Many of the state's conservative business leaders had, once the excitement of the campaign had faded, reached the same conclusion as Busby and realized that they'd been unjust to Stevenson, and they asked him to run, ample financing assured, for Tom Connolly's Senate seat in 1952. He would, after all, be only 64 years old, they pointed out. He declined. "I would not want to be the junior senator to Lyndon Johnson," he said. "It just wouldn't work. My belief in principles is too strong." He might run again, he said, but against Johnson, in 1954, when Johnson came up for re-election. To his friends, however, it was obvious that Stevenson had no enthusiasm for re-entering politics. He hadn't lost interest in politics. He still read the news magazines and all, but he'd lost interest in his participation in politics, his nephew Bob Murphy says. The stacks of mail, heavier than ever, containing now not only pleas for him to run, but information on alleged 1948 vote frauds in scores of counties, piled up on the kitchen table, unanswered. His friends felt he was considering the race mainly because life on the ranch was, again, too lonely. And then in 1954, there was a new county clerk in the courthouse. As a girl growing up on a Kimball County ranch, Marguerite King had been noted for her intelligence. She was one of the brilliant ones, a friend recalls, and for her ability as a rider and a rifle shot. I learned to shoot before I could hold the stock steady against my shoulder. I'd lean it on a rock or something, she says. But she had been nicknamed Teeny because she was barely 5 feet tall. Since then, she had left the hill country as one of the few young women from that isolated area to attend Baylor University, had married, been widowed when her husband, a pilot, had been shot down over Europe, and now, 33 years old, she had returned to Junction with her young son. But she was still petite, and her nickname had stuck. Teeny was very quiet and serious, usually staying home reading. Biography, history, anything. I tried to read 100 books a year. But beneath the quietness was determination. In 1951, when the office of Kimball County Clerk became vacant, she ran for the job and was elected, becoming the first woman in the county's history to hold elective office. The new county clerk was strikingly attractive, slender and shapely, with keen blue eyes, what friends called a whipped cream complexion, and glowing, tightly curled golden hair. Her friends kept suggesting the names of eligible young men to her, but they weren't interesting, she said. They didn't have anything to talk about. They didn't read. She was still new to the job when one day Coke Stevenson came into her office to file a case, and she was unfamiliar with the procedures involved. She would never forget the quiet, calm, kind way he explained them to her. Then they began to chat. Recalling that day many years later, she says simply, "We found we had many things in common to talk about." Stevenson was in the courthouse frequently, of course, and they had more talks. "He loved his ranch and his land," she recalls, "and he asked me if I'd like to come riding and see it. I would do that, and we would picnic on the river. That was how it all started, I guess." He invited her to go deer hunting, and that proved a little embarrassing. Famous hunter though Coke was, Teeny turned out to be the better shot. He was very good with her son, Dennis, then 9 years old. Years later, Marguerite would recall that Coke was a gifted speaker, whether to an audience of hundreds concerning the serious affairs of the state or nation, or to one little boy begging for the 50th time, "Tell me about the time you shot the bear." She saw that Coke doted on all children, and thought it was sad that Coke Jr., now chairman of the State Liquor Control Board and a big man in Austin, didn't visit the ranch more frequently so that Coke could see his two granddaughters. One day, when Bob Murphy came for a visit, instead of his uncle being alone, there was a beautiful woman with him. She seemed tiny beside Coke's height and big shoulders and was much younger. But Murphy realized that that didn't matter. "I'll never forget the way she looked at him and the way he looked at her. Uncle Coke was in love and Teeny was in love with him." On January 16, 1954, without telling anyone, for Teeny hated fuss as much as Coke did, they slipped into a little church and asked the minister to marry them. When the Junction Eagle learned of the wedding, the lead on its article told something of the near reverence in which the groom was held. Saturday, for the second time, Coke R. Stevenson, lawyer, ranchman, and former governor, took a bride from among his own people. After they were married, when Coke rode out over his ranch, Teeny rode beside him. She was a good enough rider so that when he was working with cattle, she could work with him, although she couldn't handle his big brown cutting horse, Nellie, and Coke found her a black named Elgin with a very smooth gait. When he was doing work with which she couldn't help, such as clearing cedar or driving fence posts, she would pack a lunch and bring it to him and sit by him as he worked. Worked in his 60s now, hour after hour, swinging the huge sledgehammer as he had when he was young. Teeny seemed to want to spend every minute with Coke. Late in the afternoons, they would swim in that beautiful river, with the herons and the cranes standing nearby, and the deer coming down to drink. And as for Coke, he was a different man. Or rather, he was the man he had been when he was young and had driven his car down the middle of the river on a bet. I'm going to say a word about Mr. Stevenson now that you wouldn't believe, Bob Murphy says. Bubbly. Uncle Coke was just bubbling. He just worshipped her. Murphy had a wife himself now, and she says he never walked in the kitchen that he didn't grab her and squeeze her and give her a big kiss. They were just so happy with each other. Other friends visiting the ranch would watch Teeny and Coke reading together and talking. They had the same kind of humor, the same way of looking at things, Ernest Boyette said. That dry way of observing people. They could sit and talk for hours. If that wasn't happiness, I don't know what was. And when, on January 16th, 1956, the second anniversary of their marriage, they had a daughter, Jane, Coke Stevenson's love for the little girl became, for the people of the Hill Country, a part of the story that had become, during his own lifetime, a legend to the people of Texas. He gave her a precious possession that he had obtained for himself during countless mornings with his books. He gave her history. As soon as the little girl was old enough to understand, and she was old enough very young, at 3 1/2 she was not only reading adult books but could speak fluent Spanish, Stevenson began telling her stories, wonderful stories, about the history of the United States and of Texas and of Greece and Rome. After she started school, on days when snow or ice made the roads impassable and she couldn't get to school, he and Teeny would take over her education themselves, reading to her. And when Jane was 9, Coke and Teeny started showing Jane history for herself. They had read her the accounts of the Alamo, of course, and of the battles of San Jacinto and Goliad and Sabine Pass, and they took her to all those sites, but they also ranged farther afield. They took her to see the Oregon Trail, reading Parkman's The Oregon Trail as they drove. The three of them followed the trails of Lewis and Clark, and many of the other western trails, too, trails we never hear of, Teeny recalls. Coke knew all the trails. There was the Revolution and the Founding Fathers, and there were trips to Mount Vernon and Monticello, and there was the Civil War, and all the battlefields that made up part of the history that Coke Stevenson loved. By the time Jane was a teenager, she had been taken by her mother and father to every one of the 48 states and to several provinces of Canada also. And there was a trip to a place near her home. Coming home from school one evening when she was 11, Jane told her father and mother that her class had begun studying how the state government worked. Coke took her to Austin so she could see it work for herself. Once again there was the whisper in the halls of the Capitol, "Coke Stevenson's here," and people came out of their offices into the halls to see a tall, erect old man holding by the hand a skinny little girl in pigtails. And she appreciated the gift. Jane was a good student and a good historian, Teeny says. Those trips were good. She loved history, and she and her father were very close. A reporter who spent several days with Coke when Jane was 12 was struck by the slim, pretty girl and by her relationship with her father. Stevenson is gentle-voiced with her, calls her baby, the reporter wrote, and you sense her love for the man who is big in her history books. And when she became a teenager, Coke Stevenson made for Jane what was for him the ultimate sacrifice. Newspapers across Texas chronicled it in amazement. A telephone has been installed in the Coke Stevenson ranch. Well, Stevenson drawled, you know how teenagers are. He idolized that girl. He told me many times that he hoped he would live to see her grown, Bob Murphy says. He lived to see her 19 years old and married to a young rancher, and not only did Coke live to a great age, respected throughout the Hill Country, a prophet with honor in his own country, but only in the last 3 or 4 years of his life did his health begin to fail. A reporter who went to see him wrote in 1959 that, at 71, the former governor of Texas does hard manual labor 6 days a week. All through the 60s, as he neared 80, he seemed never to be ill, and he still ranged from Wyoming to Montana to hunt the big elk, and he still worked on his ranch. He had decided to build at least rough roads connecting its 15,000 acres, and he did, 90 miles of them, and he took pride in every mile. He never lost his desire to learn new methods, deciding in about 1963, when he was 75, that he wanted to build a large garage for his tractors and other ranch machinery. He decided also that he wanted to build it without supporting columns, so that maneuvering the vehicles would be simpler. Sending away for architectural textbooks, he taught himself the science of cantilevered construction, studying these books as eagerly as 50 years before he had studied books to teach himself accounting and law and highway construction. He never lost his self-reliance and his happiness and pride when he did something on his own. And as for the law, Well, Teeny says, Coke just loved the practice of law, and he had just the pick of cases now from all over the state, and when he got a new case which was difficult, where the legalities were complicated, he was as enthusiastic and as eager about studying up on the law involved as he had been when he had first started reading law books. His love of his land, the land he had saved so long to buy, and his pride in the improvements he had made on it was so deep that visitors constantly commented on it. Taken on a tour, a guest remarked on the clarity of the water in a large tank or pond. I built that, the host said. He had built it 20 years before, he said. The water was so clear because he had lined the pond with caliche, which he had lugged from another section of the ranch. Sure, he said in response to the guest's question. It was a lot of work. But, Coke Stevenson asked, surveying the results of his labor, wasn't it worth it? If there was a single aspect of the ranch that was dearest to him, with the exception of the falls of the South Llano, how he loved that river, Teeny would recall. It was the springs which kept the ranch green and his cattle watered even during droughts that turned the rest of the hill country brown. Every time he discovered a new spring, his enthusiasm over the discovery would be as full and pure as the excitement of a young boy. The love between Coke and Teeny was striking, too, as was the contentment they brought to each other. They were to have 21 years together, and they seemed to fall only more and more in love. When he rode his ranch, by horse or car, inspecting it or cutting out cattle, Teeny still rode with him. When he was doing work in which she couldn't participate, she would still come, carrying lunch, and sit near him for hours as he worked. She began doing some of the research for his legal cases, so she was part of his life in the law, too. Says a friend, it seemed like they couldn't bear to be apart for a minute. Says Murphy, Uncle Coke told me many times how much joy she had brought him, and how he had never thought he would ever be this happy again. Teeny made sure that the Stevenson Ranch was no longer isolated. Her husband had friends, from his days as a young legislator, in fact from his days as a young cowman, all over Texas, and now Teeny invited them for visits. It was sort of an open house, one of these friends says. There were a lot of bedrooms in that house, and sometimes it seemed like they were all filled. In the evenings, Stevenson and his guests would sit around a mesquite campfire by the river drinking 10-high whiskey and swapping stories, while Coke got a good scorch on the steaks as big as saddle blankets. Coke Stevenson and Lyndon Johnson never saw each other again. Stevenson's hatred and contempt for Johnson never faded, and occasionally it would surface. Asked once during Johnson's 1964 campaign for the presidency to evaluate him, he said after a long pause, "Well, of course, he is a very, how should I say, skillful politician," and dropped the subject except to say that he himself would vote for Goldwater. "I've been waiting a long time to see a turn toward conservatism." Those who knew him well knew there were still scars from the 1948 campaign. But the scars were smoothed over by happiness. From the day Teeny agreed to marry him, Stevenson never again thought seriously about running in the 1954 campaign against Johnson, or in any other campaign. He simply had no interest in public office. His dream, after all, the dream he had conceived during those nights so long ago on the Brady Junction Trail, when 6 horses had been all he owned, had not been to be governor or senator. His dream had been to be a rancher. And now he could enjoy the realization of that dream. He would have made a great senator, Teeny says, but he loved his ranch and the life out here, and he loved practicing law. His life out here was more meaningful for him than it would have been any other way. And he knew that. He understood himself. A columnist for the Dallas News, Frank X. Tolbert, came to visit the former governor. Observing Stevenson's joy in the ranch, in the boyhood dream he had turned into reality, witnessing the enthusiasm with which he still planned and built each new improvement, seeing the serenity of the quiet evenings by the river he loved, the affection between him and his wife, the love and respect in which he was held by wife, daughter, friends, by everyone around him, Tolbert wrote, "After spending some time with Coke Robert Stevenson, here by the green rushing river, I'm wondering if he wasn't lucky to lose that Senate race by 87 votes. Those who knew Coke Stevenson didn't wonder. Bob Murphy, who had witnessed better than anyone else how hard his Uncle Coke had tried to win the Senate race, says, "Thinking back on it now, I truly believe that getting beat for the Senate and marrying Teeny was the best thing that could have happened to him." And a reporter who came to do a profile on the former governor in 1969, when Stevenson was 81 years old, didn't wonder. Watching Teenie come to meet him, the reporter wrote, "You sense a protective, motherly manner as she approaches her gray bear of a husband." Not that her husband seemed to need protection. He worked, the reporter wrote, like a ditch digger. Teenie insisted that Koch show the reporter the historic marker that had been erected by the Texas State Historical Commission on the lawn of the Kimball County Courthouse. The marker had been placed in honor of a Texas institution. "Koch R. Stevenson," it began. "Strong, resourceful, conservative governor." The reporter realized he was talking to the only man in Texas who can look out his office window and see his own monument. He realized how proud Koch was of the marker, at least partly because it bore the key word. "A conservative. He's one who holds things together," he told the reporter. "He shouldn't fight all progressive movements, but he should be the balance wheel to hold the movement to where it won't get out of hand." He had been a conservative governor, he said. "When I left office, I left a $35 million surplus." He mentioned the old age pensions he had tripled, and the public welfare payments he had increased, and the prison reforms, and the more humane treatment in state institutions for the insane, and the reporter realized how very proud Koch Stevenson was of his whole life. Then Teenie and Koch drove the reporter out to the ranch, and he saw the house and the love with which it was filled. Finally, they went down to the river. A rowboat was there, and Koch explained that Jane rows upstream, me downstream. And Teenie broke in to say with a smile, "Then they both get tired, and I have to row." A recent flash flood had changed the contours of the banks, and as the boat moved along, Koch Stevenson, 81 years old, suddenly jumped up in the boat and shouted, pointing excitedly at an Indian burial mound that the flood had uncovered. "And there were springs, new springs. There's another one," he said. "And look, there's another." He takes in the whole scene, waterfalls and deer and turkey and gentle flow of river, the whole panorama of the beautiful canyon, the reporter wrote. And then, still standing up in the boat, Koch Stevenson threw his arms wide in a gesture of triumph and joy. Chapter 18, the last chapter, Three Rings. Senators of the United States are sworn in groups of four, and at 10 minutes past noon on January 3, 1949, Lyndon Baines Johnson, with his wife and John Connolly and Buzz and Woody watching from the crowded galleries above, walked down the Senate's red-carpeted center aisle beside Burnett R. Maybank of South Carolina, who was being sworn in for a new term, and two senators-elect like himself, Robert S. Kerr of Oklahoma and Estes Kefauver of Tennessee. Standing stiffly above them on the dais, his right palm upraised, Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan, the Senate's president pro tem, read the oath. "Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States?" And the four replied together, "I do." Then, after stepping to the parliamentarian's desk below Vandenberg and signing his name in the Senate register, Johnson walked to a seat in the last row on the Democratic side of the chamber. Later that day, sitting in his new offices in front of a high-arched window that framed the Mall and the Washington Monument, he was interviewed by Margaret Mayer of the Austin American Statesman, who had followed him through most of his long campaign. Miss Mayer asked him if it had all been worth it. He nodded and winked. Then he strode out of his office and down the corridor to the elevator. He rang the elevator bell 3 times, the signal that a senator was waiting. The Senate into which Lyndon Johnson was sworn was as dominated by seniority as the House of Representatives. Power resided in the Senate club or inner circle, which consisted largely of the chairman and ranking members of the Senate's great standing committees, and of 4 party leaders, 2 floor leaders and 2 assistant floor leaders, or whips, who, unlike the Speaker of the House, were not formal officials of the Senate, but in effect held the limited powers the committee barons deigned to allow them. The sole basis for accession to a chairmanship was length of service in the Senate. A vacant chairmanship went to the man of the majority party who had been longest on that committee. And once a man became chairman, the post was his for the duration of his political life. Nothing, not even senility, could change that. As a result, 6 of the 14 committee chairmen were in their 4th or 5th Senate terms, having served a quarter of a century or more. Neither energy nor ability could circumvent the seniority rule. To become a leader in the Senate, it seemed, required waiting. Years of waiting. Within just 2 years, in January 1951, Lyndon Johnson would be a leader, his party's whip, an assistant floor leader who, moreover, very quickly began to invest that hitherto largely titular role with new significance. Just 2 years later, in January 1953, he would be the leader of his party, only minority leader since the Democrats had lost control of the Senate, but nonetheless the youngest floor leader in the history of the Senate. From that seat in the back row, he had moved in only 4 years to the Democratic leader's front row, center aisle seat, sitting at the head of men who had served as many terms in that body as he had years there. And within weeks of his election as leader, he would begin to revolutionize some of the Senate's most sacrosanct traditions in order to concentrate the baron's prerogatives in his own hands. By 1955, with the baron's power broken and the Democrats back in the majority, Lyndon Johnson was the most powerful majority leader in history. Debts. During the 14 years in which this life of Lyndon Johnson has been going forward, librarians across the United States have come to know and respect Ina Caro, an indefatigable researcher of unshakable integrity who happens to be my wife. For the first volume, in transforming herself into an expert on rural electrification and soil conservation, she spent long days driving back and forth over lonely hill country roads, searching out elderly farm and ranch women who could explain to her, and through her to me, the difference that these innovations made in their lives. For this volume, her work has been more with written materials. In pursuing them, she has crisscrossed the United States, spending weeks, for example, going through the papers of former Senator Richard B. Russell in a library in Athens, Georgia, those of Willis Robertson in a library in Williamsburg, Virginia, and those of former Presidents Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman in Hyde Park, New York, and Independence, Missouri. My beloved idealist has tracked the maneuverings of supreme pragmatists such as Tommy the Cork Corcoran and former United States Attorney General Tom Clark in the National Archives in Washington and in the Truman Library in Independence. These are major institutions. The librarians of tiny libraries in small towns all across Texas know Ina Caro as well. Over and over she has searched through these libraries until she unearthed copies of weekly newspapers that the librarians believed no longer existed. She does pioneering work. To cite one example, to find the truth about the fabled West Side vote in San Antonio, long a subject of rumor in Texas political circles, Ina wanted to analyze the precinct-by-precinct West Side voting records in a Lyndon Johnson senatorial primary during the 1940s. First, she was told that the records no longer existed, an understandable misstatement since during the intervening 40 years or so no one had looked at them. Finally, she learned that the records did in fact still exist, but were about to be destroyed, and had been stored, meanwhile, in an abandoned jail. Ina went to the jail and analyzed the records, and what she found has enriched the book. I could cite 100 examples of how Ina's research has enriched these volumes. She is a true historian in the highest sense of that term. What she is interested in is the truth, and nothing will deflect her from her search to find it. If there is a farm woman on a ranch 100 miles or more away over bad roads, a woman who might, just might, tell her something she hadn't been told before, Ina simply gets into the car and starts driving. If there is a possibility that some obscure folder, previously unopened in the papers of some United States senator in some out-of-the-way library, will shed light on some maneuver of Lyndon Johnson, Ina will be up at dawn to catch the next plane out. In a world that is hectic and frenzied, moreover, Ina Caro is quiet and calm and wise, and so are her judgments. When, after reading one of my chapters, she makes a comment about it, I have learned I'd better listen. There is a line in Shakespeare, "More is thy due than more than all can pay." I used that line in dedicating the first volume of this work to Ina because it was so apt. And as I finish writing the second volume, there is still no better line to sum up my feelings. Ina, of course, is a medieval historian in her own right, and now her own book, a wonderful book, is going forward. I don't know what I'm going to do without her help. When Robert Gottlieb, who edited my first two books line by line, left Knopf 2 years ago, he promised me that he would edit this book the same way. Not a few of my friends who are writers or editors told me, some of them quite forcefully, that that would be impossible, that Bob's new position as editor of The New Yorker would simply be too time-consuming. I, however, never had a moment's doubt that he would do what he said, no matter how great the difficulties. He had given me his word, and I had learned about Bob Gottlieb's word. And he did, in fact, edit the book just as he said he would edit it. After his long days at the New Yorker, he was sometimes too tired to edit the book in the evenings, so he did it on weekends, and we reviewed it on weekends all through a very hot summer. I remember more than one weekend on which the rest of the literary world seemed to be in East Hampton, where I have a summer home, and Bob's family was in Williamstown, where he wanted to be, and we spent it together in New York City, battling over semicolons. The editing process was not only as thorough as those on my earlier books, but the same in most other respects as well. He lavished on this book, as he had lavished on my other books, his talent, his energy, and his unique editorial intelligence. In only one respect was the editing process different this time. Whereas he had managed to edit my first and second books without once in months of work ever saying a single complimentary word about them in my hearing, this time, at the very end of the editorial process, as in fact we laid down the last page of the manuscript, he did say something. He said, "Not bad." Catherine Horrigan, Knopf's managing editor, has given the same invaluable assistance to every stage of this book that she gave to both The Power Broker and The Path to Power. Her editorial judgments are characterized, in my opinion, not only by perceptivity, but by an unflinching integrity that has only grown stronger over the years. For a number of reasons, this book presented daunting production problems. I have seen the ingenuity and the tireless effort she put into solving them, and I have appreciated it. Those problems have also taxed the patience, ingenuity, and strength of Andrew W. Hughes, the book's production manager at Knopf. I thank him for his help. Andy's father, Andrew L. Hughes, has served as my attorney on this work, as he did on my first two books. For the legal and literary advice which he began giving me while I was a reporter on Newsday and he was its general counsel, and which he has continued giving me ever since, I express to him, too, my deepest appreciation. Among the many other people at Knopf to whom I am indebted, I must thank especially my old friends Bill Lovard, Nina Bourne, Jane Friedman, Janice Goldklang, Ellis Levine, Mel Rosenthal, Virginia Tan, and Sarah Steeman. I must thank as well a new friend, Sonny Mater. It is wonderful to find in the publishing world an individual with both a discerning literary sensibility and an understanding of and sympathy for the aims and problems of writers. Over the years, my agent, Lynn Nesbitt, has always been there when I needed her. I value that relationship, and I am glad that it has continued. The staff of the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library have been, over many years now, of more help to me than I can easily express. As always, Claudia Anderson has been of particular help because of her historian's instinct and the depth of her knowledge of the contents of the Johnson archives. Tina Houston, the library's supervisory archivist, and Mike Gillette, Linda Hansen, Ted Gittinger, David Humphrey, Joan Kennedy, E. Philip Scott, Nancy Smith, Robert Tissing, Shelyn Wooker, Regina Greenwell, Irene Parra, and Kathy Frankham deserve and have my deep gratitude for years of help. For some years now, I have also had not only the cooperation but the guidance of Dr. Richard A. Baker and Dr. Donald A. Ritchie, historian and associate historian, respectively, of the United States Senate. While the assistance they have given me deals mainly with events that I describe in the next volume, I want to thank them now as well. Baker and Ritchie are both historians of great diligence and insight, and I appreciate all they have done. My thanks also to Dennis Bilger, archivist, and Benedict K. Zabrist, director of the Harry S. Truman Library, Betsy Huden, Special Collections, the University of Texas at Arlington, Margaret Rose, librarian at the Corpus Christi Public Library, Diane Bruce of the Institute of Texan Culture, Sharon Jenkins, supervisor at the FCC, Audrey Bateman of Austin, Louis Marchefeva of the Houston Metropolitan Research Center, Paul McLaughlin at the Franklin D. Roosevelt Library, Claire Maxwell of the Austin Public Library, Paul K. Good of the James C. Jernigan Library at Texas A&I in Kingsville, Don Jacobson at the Fort Worth Public Library. A note on sources. The research for these first two volumes of My Life of Lyndon Johnson, two volumes which together cover what I consider the Texas part of the work, since in the volumes to come the focus will shift to Washington, has taken place over the past 14 years. A portion of it has taken place at a single location, a desk, 2.5 feet by 4 feet, in the reading room on the 8th floor of the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library and Museum in Austin, Texas, where on periodic visits to the library I sat while the library's archivists wheeled into me on large wooden carts the document cases, some plain red or gray cardboard, mostly covered in red buckram and stamped with a gold replica of the presidential seal, which contained the written materials, letters, memoranda, scribbled notes, transcripts of telephone conversations, speech texts, relating to my subject's boyhood, his early years as a schoolteacher, congressional aide, and Texas State Director of the National Youth Administration, his 11.5 years as a congressman from Texas's 10th Congressional District, and his 1948 campaign to become one of the state's two United States senators. Other boxes contain his Senate papers, which I've studied primarily for my third volume, but which, of course, contained more than a little information that helped illuminate that earlier period. In all, during those 14 years, a total of 787 boxes were delivered to my desk. They contained, by the library's estimate, 629,000 pages of documents. How many of those pages I read, I don't know, but I read a lot of them. The time I have spent at that desk has been a wonderful time, thrilling, in fact. From the first time I thought of becoming a biographer, I never conceived of my biographies as merely telling the lives of famous men, but rather as a means of illuminating their times and the great forces that shape their times, particularly political power, since in a democracy, political power has so great a role in shaping the lives of the citizens of that democracy. What I set out to try to do was to examine the way power works in America in the middle of the 20th century. I have been fascinated by political power ever since I was a reporter and realized how little I knew about it. And you can learn quite a bit about that subject if you just sit there and read enough documents in the Lyndon Johnson Library. A single example, one of 100 that could be given, will perhaps illustrate what I mean. When I was beginning the research, one of my first interviews was with Thomas G. Tommy the Cork Corcoran, Franklin Roosevelt's political man-of-all-work and a Johnson intimate during his early rise to power. By this time, I'd found that the crucial time in which young Johnson was elevated from the mass of congressmen to a congressman with influence over other congressmen, a congressman with at least his first toehold on national power, occurred during a single month, October 1940. When I asked Corcoran how Johnson had attained this power, Corcoran replied in his gruff, cryptical way, "Money, kid, money, but you're never going to be able to write about that." When I asked him why I would never be able to write about that, he replied, "Because you're never going to find anything in writing." For some years thereafter, perhaps 3 or 4 years, I felt that Corcoran was correct. But then, among those hundreds of boxes in the Johnson Library, there before me, suddenly, in boxes 6, 7, 8, and 9 of the Johnson House papers, to be exact, was the written documentation of what Corcoran had meant. And I was able to understand, and I hope to explain, in Chapter 32 of Volume 1, Lyndon Johnson's leap to national power through the campaign contributions he obtained from Texas oil men and contractors to whom he alone had access and that he distributed at his sole discretion to other congressmen. Here is a description of the papers in the Johnson Library that form part of the foundation of these first two volumes and an explanation of how they are identified in the notes that follow. House of Representatives Papers, JHP. The memoranda, both intra-office and with others, casework, speech drafts and texts, and other papers kept in the files of Johnson's congressional office from 1937 through 1948. These papers also include records pertaining to his other activities during this period, records which were originally compiled by his staff and other offices, such as the records compiled in an office he temporarily rented in Washington's Muncie office building when he was raising money for Democratic congressmen in 1940, and records kept in his Austin campaign headquarters during his first campaign for Congress in 1937 and his campaign for the Senate in 1941. More than 70 boxes of documents contain about 56,000 pages of material on his 1948 senatorial campaign. These include letters and memoranda from campaign headquarters in Austin to district leaders and campaign aides in the field, confidential intra-office memoranda, communications between the Austin headquarters and Johnson's congressional office in Washington, and reports from local campaign managers on Johnson's activities and behavior in their districts. These boxes also contain memoranda sent back to Austin from Horace Busby, who traveled with Johnson during part of the campaign. Also in these boxes are Busby's suggested releases and speech drafts, including releases to be issued and speeches to be given by others. These boxes also contain poll tax lists, lists of the candidates' supporters, contacts and potential financial contributors, with notes about them, briefing papers for the candidate, newspaper clippings, schedules, and expense accounts. They include scribbled notes from one headquarters worker to another. Lyndon Baines Johnson Archives, LBJA. These files were created about 1958 and consist of material taken from both the House of Representatives papers and from Johnson's Senate papers. It consists of material considered historically valuable or of correspondence with persons with whom he was closely associated, such as Sam Rayburn, Abe Fortas, James Rowe, George and Herman Brown, Edward Clark, and Alvin Wirtz. or of correspondence with national figures of that era. These files are divided into four main categories. Selected names, correspondence with close associates, famous names, correspondence with national figures, congressional file, correspondence with fellow congressmen and senators, and subject file. This contains a biographic information file with material relating to Johnson's year as a schoolteacher in Catulla and Houston, to his work as a secretary to Congressman Richard M. Clayburgh, to his activities with the Little Congress, and to his naval service during World War II. Pre-presidential confidential file. This contains material taken from other files because it dealt with potentially sensitive areas. Pre-presidential memo file. This file consists of memos taken from the House of Representatives papers, the Johnson Senate papers, and the vice presidential papers. While these memos begin in 1939 and continue through 1963, there are relatively few prior to 1946. While most are from the staff, some are from Johnson to the staff. The subject matter of the memos falls in numerous categories, ranging from specific issues, the 1948 Senate campaign, liberal versus conservative factions in Texas, phone messages, and constituent relations. Family correspondence. Correspondence between the president and his mother and brother, Sam Houston Johnson. Personal papers of Rebecca Baines Johnson. This is material found in her garage after she died. It includes correspondence with her children, including Lyndon, and other members of her family, and material collected by her during her research into the genealogy of the Johnson family. It also includes scrapbooks. Personal papers of Alvin Wirtz, 25 boxes. Senate papers. The scope is similar to that of the House papers, however, these files are far more extensive than the House papers. These papers include committee files dealing with specific committees on which Johnson served, and the papers collected when he was Democratic leader during the years 1951 to 60. Senate political files. These files cover a time period from 1949 to 1960. They concern the consolidation of Johnson's position in Texas following the 1948 campaign, the 1954 Senate campaign, and Johnson's 1956 bid for the presidency, as well as numerous county files. They were made into a separate file by the library staff. White House Central File. The only files in this category used to a substantial extent in this volume were the subject files labeled President Personal. They contain material about the president or his family, mainly articles written after he became president about episodes in his early life. White House Famous Names File. This includes correspondence with former presidents and their families, including Johnson correspondence when he was a congressman with Franklin D. Roosevelt. Record Group 48, Secretary of the Interior, Central Classified Files. Microfilm from the National Archives, containing documents relating to Lyndon Johnson found in the files of the Department of the Interior. Documents concerning Lyndon B. Johnson from the papers of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt, John M. Carmody, Harry L. Hopkins, and Aubrey Williams. This microfilm reel was compiled at the Franklin D. Roosevelt Library at Hyde Park and consists of correspondence to and from Johnson found in various PPF and OF files at the Roosevelt Library. Whenever possible, the author has included the file number by which the original documents can be located at the Roosevelt Library. Johnson House Scrapbooks. 21 scrapbooks of newspaper clippings compiled by members of his staff between 1935 and 1941. Each document from the LBJ Library is cited in the notes by the title of the folder in which it can be found, the box number, and the collection in the library. If no folder title is included in the citation, the folder is either the name of the correspondent in the letter, or, in the case of files kept alphabetically, the appropriate letter, a letter from Corcoran, for example, in the folder labeled C. Written documents can never tell the whole story, of course, and as in the first volume, I have also relied heavily on interviews with the men and women closest to Lyndon Johnson during the 7 years covered by this volume. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.